hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Gallup, and today we're going to dive into a new hospital history, but we aren't going very far. We're staying in Massachusetts, but heading an hour south of Danvers to Taunton. I'll be relying heavily on the book, A Brief History of the Taunton Lunatic Hospital, 1854 to 2016 by Joseph Langlois throughout this episode and series. All other sources will be listed at the end of the episode transcript. So come on in and get comfortable as we go behind the walls of Taunton State Hospital. In our last series on Danvers State Hospital, I had mentioned that it was the fourth lunatic asylum to be built in Massachusetts, but the first built in the Kirkbride style. I'd gotten that information from the Danvers State Hospital website, but turns out that wasn't 100% accurate. So thank you to Lisa for pointing out that the three previous hospitals were constructed or reconstructed into Kirkbrides before Danvers. So, as always, I don't claim to be an expert on these hospitals, but I do my best to be as accurate as I can be. And I always invite folks to send me more information or personal stories or what have you about these hospitals because there's always so much to know. And even in a multi-part series, I'm going to overlook so much just for the sake of time. But anyway, I wanted to back up just a bit for those of you who are new to the show and just listening for the first time. At the beginning of the 1800s, folks who were deemed lunatics or mad were housed in jails or almshouses. And when they referred to lunatics, their definition was quite broad. It meant anyone who had symptoms of a mental illness, anyone who struggled with alcohol or substance use addiction, anyone who had a physical defect of some kind, or anyone who was poor. So picture, if you will, the Cratchit family from Charles Dickens' story, A Christmas Carol, which was written in 1843. These weren't necessarily folks who would be considered insane by today's standards, but they were working class and had a son with physical disability who begged for change in the streets. Those are the type of folks who could potentially end up in an almshouse or jail for being deemed socially unacceptable. So the conditions these folks endured, especially in the local jails, was abysmal. They were chained to posts, sometimes poorly clad or naked, and housed in cold, damp cells. They weren't given much care, if they were given any, and reformers worked hard to get their conditions changed. In 1833, the first lunatic asylum was built in Worcester, Massachusetts, to house the pauper poor from Boston. Just a few years later, in 1839, the Boston Lunatic Hospital opened. But even with the efforts of these two new facilities, there were simply too many people admitted, and the sites quickly became overcrowded. On March 28, 1841, Dorothea Dix went to teach a Sunday school class at the East Cambridge Jail. The things she witnessed there forever changed her and the treatment of mental illness. After seeing the horrifying conditions inmates were forced to live in, Dorothea Dix traveled up and down the East Coast, visiting jails and poorhouses and asylums and documenting how people were treated. She wrote a memorial to the Massachusetts legislature appealing for change, and her petition was granted. Funds were later set aside for building insane asylums to humanely treat folks with mental illness. And this set off a domino effect of asylums being built to house and treat folks who had been previously incarcerated. We also have to remember, as we'd mentioned during the series on the Provincial Lunatic Asylum in Toronto, that there was an influx of immigration during the 1840s, particularly from Ireland. The Irish potato famine had started in 1845, which displaced many folks who immigrated to the east coast of the United States. As we discussed in those episodes on the Toronto Asylum, anyone perceived as different risked ending up in an asylum because they didn't adhere to social norms. By the late 1840s, with the asylums in Worcester and Boston already over capacity, it became clear that a new asylum would need to be built. In 1851, a site for the new asylum was proposed in Taunton. 2 years later, in 1853, construction began on what would end up being an elaborate Kirkbride-style building. It was designed by the Boyden and Ball architecture firm from Boston. Eldridge Boyden, of Boyden and Ball, would end up being considered one of the finest architects of the mid-19th century and would go on to design many notable university and civic buildings, as well as churches. In typical Kirkbride fashion, the new asylum would be built in the countryside on a large piece of land. The citizens of Taunton contributed $13,000 to purchase the 134-acre parcel the asylum would be built on. This area was specifically chosen because it bordered the Mill River, which would provide a natural barrier to the city creeping up on the asylum. And it was described as follows. Quote, "The grounds of the 134 acres extend in a southerly direction to within a half mile of the center of town. With an exceedingly varied surface, a beautiful grove of more than 60 acres, and bounded by a river for nearly half its extent, the site has natural advantages that are rarely met with. As nearly all the land lies between the hospital and the town, and its position is furthermore strengthened by having a river for the natural barrier, the institution will probably be able to hold at bay for many years the encroachments of an increasing population and will avoid the difficulty into which many similar institutions have fallen, of being gradually drawn, in the consequence of the increase of a flourishing town, into the heart of a city." End quote. Once they had the location picked out, it was time to start building. Construction of the new hospital began in 1853. The building itself was designed in the neoclassical style and constructed in the shape of an E, with one wing for women and one wing for men. The front entrance was impressive and imposing. It rose 3 stories high and had a large dome on top, sort of similar to the dome on top of St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican, if you're familiar with that. The first floor had office space, reception rooms, and living quarters for the superintendent, so it was primarily an administrative area. There was a large hall that was used as an assembly room, a chapel, an auditorium, and it would later be known as the finest hall remaining in the United States from the pre-Civil War era. The first superintendent of Taunton, Dr. George C.S. Choate, added this information about the central block. Quote, "The center building has a frontage of 55 feet toward the town and projects from the main front about 50 feet. In this are the office, dispensary, apartments for the officers, and rooms for the reception of visitors and social intercourse of patients. It is surmounted by a dome, which rises 70 feet above the roof, and from which there is a panoramic view of great beauty embracing the neighboring town, with its many tokens of busy life, several flourishing villages, the numerous ponds and streams with which the surrounding country abounds, and reaching in the far distance even to the blue hills of Norfolk County." End quote. Now, interestingly, the lower story of the main block included what were called strong rooms. Joseph Langlois notes that there were 42 of these strong rooms that were originally designed to contain violent or, quote, filthy patients. They were built with stone, brick, and iron with walls 16 inches thick. The floors were made of wood and were sloped toward a stone. Langlois said that when he ventured down to the strong rooms, they were like a dungeon. And even better, there was only one narrow passageway leading to them from the central administration block. Emergency exits were clearly not a consideration back then. Now, fortunately, the one saving grace to come out of the construction of these strong rooms is that they were never used for their intended purpose. Dr. Choate later said about the following about the strong rooms, quote, We urge upon all who have care of the insane to abandon what we regard as the barbarous relics of an ancient and mistaken policy, and at least try the experiment of that system, which is based upon the enduring principles of human kindness and love. End quote. I appreciate that most, if not all, of these asylums did practice using kindness and love, at least for a while until it got out of hand. I'm really surprised the strong rooms weren't used later, to be honest. If I had to guess, they probably ended up being used as storage spaces over the years. By early 1854, construction had completed and the asylum was ready to begin accepting patients. On April 7, 1854, the first patients were transferred from Worcester Asylum to Taunton. Most of these patients were described as demented, medically infirmed, and of a chronically disabled nature. Most of the new patients were between 25 and 45 years old, but the youngest was a boy only 6 years old. Langlois wasn't able to find why he was admitted so young. Most of the new admits were farmers, laborers, and seamen who had been born in the U.S. The most frequent causes of insanity for men included intemperance, ill health, masturbation, religious excitement, and trouble about property. For women, the most common cases of causes of insanity were ill health and religious excitement. Most of these reasons would definitely not be causes of admission to a state hospital today, except perhaps if the intemperance were linked to a mood disorder or religious excitement were delusional in nature. During the first year the new asylum was open, a total of 330 patients were admitted, 211 from Worcester alone. And you have to remember that Kirkbride hospitals were designed for a capacity of about 250 patients. So this doesn't mean that all 330 were there at the same time, though. Throughout the first year it was open, 64 patients were discharged, 24 died, and 3 eloped. Langlois points out that the most frequent causes of death were phthisis, which was also known as tuberculosis or consumption, dysentery, apoplexy, which is basically a stroke, and manic exhaustion. It's been a while since I've discussed manic exhaustion, but if you've ever seen someone in a true manic episode, it can be exhausting just watching them. Of course, mania looks different in different people. I am thinking particularly of a patient I worked with years ago who was struggling through a really obvious and almost stereotypical, if you will, manic episode. It was like he couldn't be turned off. He was yelling nonstop, constantly moving and pacing and hitting walls. He wasn't sleeping. He wasn't stopping to rest. He didn't want to eat. You get the picture. And the medications were only doing so much for him at the very beginning of treatment. And I remember thinking, it's no wonder people just dropped dead before mood stabilizers came along. The body has to slow itself down somehow. Anyway, you may also be wondering how those three patients escaped. They were working outside, probably on construction of part of the hospital or a nearby road, and ran off while they were out. Strangely, and almost inconceivably today, there were only 22 staff members to care for the 330 patients who came through the hospital that year. Even if we round down and estimate that only 250 patients were there at any given time, that would still be over an 11-to-1 ratio of patients to staff. The staff at the hospital included Dr. Choate, the superintendent, Dr. Z.B. Adams, assistant physician. There was a clerk of records, a housekeeper in charge of kitchen stores, a cook, a seamstress, an engineer, a farmer, 7 attendants for the male wing, and 7 attendants for the female wing. Now, Dr. Choate had way too much responsibility on his shoulders as superintendent. Somehow he was expected to see each patient on a daily basis. And he was responsible for ensuring, quote, the medical, moral, and physical well-being and treatment of his patients, end quote. I don't know that I'd want to be responsible for my patients' moral well-being for many reasons. But Dr. Choate was also in charge of hiring all employees and managing the budget. That's just way too much work for one person to assume. I would have a hard time checking in with all 40 of my patients in a single day. The hospital as a whole practiced the tenets of moral therapy, which included a good diet, exercise, lack of stress, good ventilation, amusements, and the opportunity to work. Langlois adds that there were many different types of recreational opportunities, including singing classes, reading, bowling for the men, and something called a magic lantern show, which he says were an early form of slide projector and a popular form of entertainment at the time. I had to look this up, and there's a link on the Facebook page if you're interested. It seems really quite fascinating. There was a projector, which looks sort of similar to a movie projector, and glass slides that had still images painted on them. But the magic part of the show was that there were two other projectors running at the same time that also had slides in them. And the other images projected onto the screen so it would give the illusion of movement. It was all fairly simple, but I'm sure patients and staff alike really enjoyed these shows. As for work opportunities, these developed over the years, but they would go on to include the farm and garden. Even though apparently the land was known for its sandy soil that was really not good for gardening. And later, when a road was added that connected the asylum to a public road, it was patients who staffed its labor. And what I found particularly disturbing about the addition of this road was that it seemed to unintentionally invite members of the public to drive out to the asylum on Sundays. They'd peek in through the windows, especially at women patients. And I find this disturbing for so many reasons, but it really just highlights how vulnerable patients were. The second year of the hospital's operation began in 1855. The overall population rose to 262 patients, including five prisoners who had allegedly gone insane while in prison. One inmate had been convicted of murder and made several attempts to escape while at the hospital, making him an inherently high-risk patient. And you got to remember that most of the patients at the asylum hadn't committed a crime. They were just regular people with mental illness or seizures or problems with their spouse or neighbor. So mixing the criminally insane with everyone else posed serious problems. One of the issues staff faced is something that continues to be an issue today, although we manage it better today. Patients who are at imminent risk of harm to themselves or others need to be watched by a one-to-one staff member. In Taunton, this essentially took away one of the seven attendants on that side of the hospital, leaving fewer people to care for the 100-and-something patients in that wing. Today, when we have a staff who is on a one-to-one observation for a patient, we're allowed to get an extra staff member to make up the difference so we don't lose a set of eyes on the patients. A number of improvements were also made during the second year of operation. According to Joseph Langlois, a separate laundry building was added as well as a bowling alley. In addition, there was an improved steam delivery system, library expansion, and the development of a singing school. Local newspapers gave free subscriptions to the hospital. A concert was given by the Beethoven Society of Taunton. A chapel was established, as well as reading and sewing rooms. A horse and carriage were purchased, and a fence was placed around the farm, and over 50 trees were planted. By 1856, the patient population had gone up to 298, with an average of 15 admissions per month. There were now 37 employees at the hospital. This was the same year that the Northampton Asylum opened as well. Now, we have to remember, as I mentioned earlier, that running in the background of all of this was the huge influx of immigrants from Ireland. I had mentioned earlier, the Irish potato famine of the late 1840s and early 1850s had essentially forced many people to flee Ireland. Many of them came to Massachusetts. And anytime there's a large group of people who are different from the majority, there are going to be misunderstandings and prejudice. And among Irish immigrants, there was a fair amount of disappointment. Many had left for the U.S. in search of prosperity and a new start, only to struggle once they arrived. Dr. Choate made a particularly icky remark about Irish immigrants who ended up at the asylum. Quote, "They are peculiarly apt to fall into a state of hopelessness and dementia. They leave their own country with the most exalted and highly colored notions of prosperity. This disappointment is too much for their minds, uncultivated and narrow as they are by education and religion," end quote. Today, most, hopefully all, mental health professionals look at the multiple stressors that influence someone's diagnostic picture. Someone who had just arrived, survived a famine in their home country, and made the probably heart-wrenching decision to take their family and move to a completely new country, only to not be able to find work and struggle to feed their family there, would or should be met with a clinician who understands the layers of stressful situations that person has endured. But instead, doctors in the 19th century just ascribed immigrants' very real traumas to them being uncultivated. That's great, just great. And as we've mentioned, people who weren't able to fit into society were at higher risk of being sent to an asylum. So by 1856, 43% of admissions were foreign-born individuals, most of whom were Irish. A law was passed that stated that all lunatics needed to be sent to state hospitals, but the, quote, "American insane" could be kept at the Boston Lunatic Hospital. So there was this, some sort of segregation happening that kept U.S.-born patients predominantly at one facility, but foreign-born patients predominantly at another facility. In 1858, the number of admissions around Massachusetts had increased substantially, so the Lunatic Hospital in Northampton was opened to relieve overcrowding at all the existing facilities. Within 2 months of it opening, Northampton had already exceeded its capacity after taking transfers from other asylums around the state. In only a few short years, in 1862, the hospital population at Taunton had largely increased to 425. Finally, construction began on a stone wall that would encircle the hospital and curb all those creepers who traveled out on Sundays to peer at the patients. It's really something that they were less concerned about the patients getting out than they were of the public looking in, like patients were spectacles on display. And just an aside, because I find it interesting, the salaries of employees were listed in the book by Langlois, and here is what staff earned in 1862. Dr. Choate, the superintendent, earned $1,800 a year, which is the equivalent of around $55,663 a year today. The assistant physician earned $600 a year, so about $18,554 a year today. The treasurer earned $225 a year. The assistant seamstress earned $168 a year. The engineer earned $480 a year. The baker earned $360 a year. The male attendants earned $240 a year. Female attendants earned $168 a year. The laundress earned $156 a year. And the lowest paid employee was the cook, who earned $104 a year. So that's, even with inflation, that's that's pretty pretty low. And so just to give a sort of equivalent, so like I mentioned, Dr. Choate was earning the equivalent of $55,000 a year today. Today, the medical director's salaries with the California Department of State Hospitals start around $300,000 a year. And to be fair, they work incredibly hard. It's a job I don't think I would want to have. But remember that Dr. Choate was also meeting with every patient individually every day, hiring employees, and doing the bookkeeping. Also in 1862, the asylum was continuing to expand and offer more amenities and services to patients. They added a new billiard room, more books to the library, added stables and new furnishings. And I'm actually surprised that they added new furnishings only 8 years after the asylum opened, especially given the historical context of what was going on at the time. The American Civil War had started the previous year in 1861. Massachusetts was a northern state, so several of their male employees left to join the Union Army. And we have to remember that the asylum didn't have that many employees to begin with, so any loss of staffing must have been incredibly difficult. Impressively, though, the staff seemed to recognize the toll that this war would have upon troops and citizens alike. In the 1862 annual report, Dr. Choate predicted that the war would lead to a corresponding increase in cases of mental disturbance. Today, we might recognize this as symptoms of trauma, with some cases likely meeting criteria for PTSD. Admissions during the Civil War slowed somewhat, and the total patient population in 1863 was 421. Patients still participated in work assignments that included road and wall construction. This would be physically demanding and potentially dangerous work conditions, and we have to remember that patients weren't compensated for their work. It was considered a necessary component of their treatment. And while I see a lot of value in having patients work, not paying them just leads to exploitation. Today, at least in California, patients in state hospitals who have jobs earn federal minimum wage and are subject to taxes just like anyone else. In 1870, Dr. Choate retired after 16 years as superintendent of Taunton Lunatic Asylum. He was succeeded by Dr. William W. Godding, who, according to Joseph Langlois, was considered one of the eminent physicians of his time. Dr. Godding approved a number of improvements for the asylum, including a new ventilation system, new windows, and adding family visiting rooms and an expanded food menu. They added more private patient rooms as well, which makes me wonder if this was to increase revenue to the hospital itself. There was a new drainage system installed, as well as a carpenter's shop and a new laundry room. Now, notably, Dr. Godding was able to facilitate getting $125,000 to expand the hospital. He had pleaded before the state legislature about the inadequate conditions of the asylum, noting that there were only 4 wards for men and 4 wards for women. One of the wards, he said, was quite small, whereas the others contained 60 to 70 patients each. By securing additional funds, he hoped to expand to having 10 wards for men and 10 wards for women. I think this would probably also improve safety and patient care. In 1877, after only 7 years as superintendent, Dr. Godding resigned to become the governor of the Hospital for the Insane in Washington, D.C. This is what would later become St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Also in 1877, the second asylum in Worcester opened. This was the one that was built in the Kirkbride style and was called the Hospital for the Chronically Insane. If we recall from our series on the Provincial Lunatic Asylum in Toronto, there were 2 types of insane asylums at this time. One for acutely ill patients who had a fairly reasonable chance of improvement and discharge within a year or two, and one for chronically ill patients, those who had less hope for a full recovery because of their mental illness or what we consider today a developmental disorder. So once the second asylum in Worcester opened, Taunton was able to send over some of its more chronically ill patients. As a result, there was a drop in the patient census over the following year, from 782 in 1877 to 579 in 1878. And you also may remember from our previous series that Danvers State Hospital opened in 1878, which further relieved overcrowding, at least for a moment. Dr. John Peasley Brown became the third superintendent of Taunton Lunatic Asylum in 1878. He had been working at the New Hampshire Asylum for the previous 12 years, so he came with some experience. By this time, the superintendent earned $2,500 a year, or the equivalent of about $78,000 a year today. The lowest paid employee was a female cook who earned $3 a week, or the equivalent of about $4,800 a year today. Patients were expected to work, of course, in addition to reading, exercising, attending chapel, and going to Friday night entertainments. The latter would include games of various sorts, being read to by the assistant physician, which I think is cute, the magic lantern shows I mentioned earlier, and a series of lectures and concerts. In order to encourage more physical activity, two wards were left unlocked so that patients could come and go to get exercise. And as it turned out, this proved to be effective in reducing aggressive behavior toward others, as well as reducing self-injurious behavior. Dr. Brown was very proud of the diet the hospital offered its patients. He said, quote, "Most of our patients are poorly fed and badly nourished before coming to the hospital. In the beginning of treatment, in those cases, we depend more on good, nourishing food than the material medica. Milk and eggs, with wine and other stimulants, being more freely dispensed than any form of drugs, though the latter are frequently called to our aid," end quote. And I just have to giggle here. Yeah, I bet the patients were doing just fine with their regimen of wine and stimulants. If that's the front line of defense, but they also have other drugs at their disposal when needed, I think they would like that. I assume here he's referring to laudanum and ipecac and opium and other similar treatments. I mean, my patients would probably be happy too if we fed them booze and drugs all day long. Probably helps after that long day of building roads. In 1881, there were 556 patients and 102 employees at Taunton. That same year, 27 inmates were transferred from nearby prisons, and this required special arrangements to keep the inmates and other patients safe. Restraints were used sparingly, about 2% of the time with male patients and 4% of the time with female patients. Langlois says the most common restraint device was a belt with wristers that restricted hand movements and the individual's reach. We have something similar that we use today, though infrequently at my hospital. Walking wrist restraints, we call them, allow a patient who is struggling with aggression to be able to move somewhat freely about the unit, but restricts their arm movements. They can't hit anyone. They're still able to sit and read and eat and write. They just can't forcefully extend a fist. There were more elderly and medically compromised patients being admitted to Taunton, which led to a corresponding increase in the number of patient deaths, most of whom died from dementia, but others, sadly, died from what turned out to be an unusually hot and dry summer. Today, we have to be extra careful during the summer with patients who are taking certain psychotropic medications, as some can increase their body temperature during warm months. So to prevent hyperthermia, we have to be mindful of the weather outside and not take patients out if it's above a certain temperature. Men at the asylum worked on the farm, in the laundry, piggery, kitchen, bakery, and carpenter's shop, as well as in groundskeeping and food distribution. Women were tasked with knitting, sewing, kitchen and laundry work. In one year, they made 460 dresses, 959 sheets, 253 suspenders, 1,183 bath towels, and hemmed 76 rugs. In 1883, there were 674 patients, 124 over capacity. Most patients were admitted with a diagnosis of paresis, most likely caused by late-stage syphilis. There were so many people being admitted with communicable diseases that Dr. Brown decided there needed to be an infirmary in the attic. The hospital also recommended adding a training school for nurses of the insane. As Joseph Langlois points out, 1884 was an important year for women at the hospital. Two women, Ruth S. Murray and Grace S. Bartlett, were appointed to the Board of Trustees. The state's first female assistant physician, Dr. Alice Rogers, was also appointed. And this is pretty progressive for the late 19th century. And lastly, in 1886, 30 years after it started, the wall surrounding the asylum was finally completed. So, 3 decades later, the wall would finally keep members of the public from peering into windows and gawking at patients like some sort of sideshow. For the sake of their privacy, I'm sorry it took that long to complete. And that's where I'm going to end part one of the history of Taunton State Hospital. Tune in next time to find out what my favorite part of the old hospital was and why I was drawn to cover it on the show. As always, thank you so much for listening. If you're a new listener, thank you for joining us and checking it out. Feel free to check out the Facebook and Instagram pages for pictures, updates, and random things I find interesting about these old hospitals. Wherever you are listening, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe, but super extra bonus points if that's on Apple Podcasts. Special shout out this week to AmishiaB96 for their review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you to Heather for supporting me monthly on Buzzsprout for the past year. That has meant so much to me. And I also have a Patreon page. Some of you have been to it, I see, but I'm struggling with some technical difficulties that are I really think they're just user error. But once I figure it out, it's going to be great. I already have some recordings ready to go, so I will be sure to let everyone know once that's available. In the meantime, if you'd like to support the show, you can go to my Buzzsprout page and sign up for $3 a month, or you can go to my Beacons page and go to the Buy Me a Coffee icon. Any donations there will probably not be used so much for coffee, but more for the zillions of books that I buy on each of the hospitals I cover. But just know that I appreciate you all. I know I say this often, but I really had no idea that so many people would listen to my little show. I really thought it would just be me talking to myself and maybe my mom. But it's been so nice to connect with all the other people who are interested in learning more about these old hospitals and learning more about the people who lived there. So thank you so much. I appreciate it. And as always, remember the words of Maya Angelou: do the best you can until you know better. And then when you know better, do better. Until next time. Thank you so much for listening to Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. Once again, I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Gallup. Cover image is by Christopher Payne. Check out my website at behindthewallspodcast.buzzsprout.com. Follow the podcast and learn more on Facebook at Behind the Walls Podcast and Instagram at Behind the Walls Pod. For questions or recommendations, email me at behindthewallspodcast@gmail.com. You can find new episodes every Monday on Amazon Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening right now. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find and listen to the show, and I would be so grateful. Please stay tuned for more episodes of Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. Until next time.